Welcome to our Classical Music Daily December 2020 newsletter. This month, as an experiment, we're publishing it as a podcast. You've just been listening to the end of Improvisation No. 7525 by the Bulgarian pianist Emil Naumov, who studied with Nadia Boulanger and who has written of these times in his book Emil Naumov, My Chronicles with Nadia Boulanger. Jenna Orkin, who also knew Boulanger, has read this book. Jenna, how did you come to meet Boulanger and Naumov?
Well, I went to Fontainebleau in 1978, and it was almost Nadia Boulanger's last summer teaching there, so it was very historic. And some of the time she gave us classes from her bed. She couldn't get out of bed. And she relied heavily on her foremost student, Emil Naumov, who was at the time 16, and we were all in our 20s. And Emil is an out-and-out traditional motherfucking genius. And if you go to a website he has, or his, I don't know, a YouTube channel or something, he improvises. You can use some of that abundantly. Extraordinary education in music. So I'll give you some excerpts. He was brought to Boulanger when he was seven, pretty much because a family friend advised them that Bulgaria, his native country, you know, he'd outstripped their resources as far as music went. So they moved to Paris to be with this woman, not even knowing if she was still alive. The Iron Curtain, I guess. Yeah, the Iron Curtain was still up and they had no way. And they found out she was, and they made their way to her apartment. Now I'm going to read to you, I quote this section of his memoir in the review, but this is Emil talking. His parents asked a woman they encountered on the street. Now this is quoting from Emil. Only realizing after they asked the question that she was a prostitute, perhaps 40 or 50 years old, distinguished enough, if a little odd, with a rather pronounced nose and an air of Toulouse-Lautrec in her ancestry. And then Emil's father told him that the women like this one that they've just seen were guardians of the neighborhood, rather like police women. So it seemed, well, in a broad sense, that was probably true. So they go to Boulanger, she's over 80, and she tells them that, yes, she is the answer, and indeed she was. I mean, it sounds like hubris, but by no means. And he studied with her until she died about three times a week, also with her assistant, the very renowned and extraordinarily accomplished Annette Dieudonné for solfège, clef reading, an education which I don't even think is done anymore. All aspects of music. And that's the heart of this book. But anyway, oh, here he is describing going up to Boulanger's apartment in the tiny elevator, as is often the case in buildings where such a luxury was never foreseen, with its mesh wired door closing like a noisy guillotine, and its arrival at mid-floor, the same mid-floor that Nadia Boulanger's cardiologist would carry her across after her last day at Fontainebleau in 1979, an effort that contributed to his own collapse and death later that day, news that no one dared to tell her. Well, and the people that Emil meets in her entourage are amazing. I mean, from Stravinsky's son, I believe, to Leonard Bernstein, to poets, everybody was in that salon of hers on Wednesday afternoons.
Must have been an incredible time.
Must have been. Yeah. And she was a student of Fauré, and she used to, apparently, substitute Fauré for Fauré where he played the, where was that? The Madeleine in Paris, where he played the organ, and she was underage, but she snuck in when he couldn't make it, and she would improvise for the congregation there.
Amazing.
And there are stories about, you know, Camille Saint-Saëns getting in her way for the Prix de Rome. I mean, history marches across these pages, and Émile is still with us teaching in Indiana.
Thanks very much, Jenna. Émile Nalmoff's book is free to download and read from his website. And like many of the items you'll hear about in this podcast, you can read Jenna's review in full with links to Nalmoff and his book at classicalmusicdaily.com. A special page linked from our newsletters page will give you the links to everything mentioned in this newsletter. Gerald Fennec has been listening to lots of CD recordings. He begins by recommending the recent Beethoven and Gossec recording from Harmonia Mundi.
Well, this is a very good recording, really, you know, and the way the conductor Ross has been doing these albums with his cat Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition, and the way the recording comes out is absolutely amazing. The repeat in the fourth movement is quite something, which can be comparable to the Gardiner recording from 1994 with the Orchestra Révolutionnaire et Romantique, which was basically the same kind of period setup, which features in this recording. Mm-hmm. Then we have the Gossec Symphony, which is very interesting, which I hadn't heard before, to be quite honest, and it was quite an original sound, and the way it's panned out, especially with the second movement, it's kind of similar to some of the Beethoven pieces, really. Actually, Gossec had a longer lifespan than Beethoven, but he spent almost all Beethoven's lifetime, actually quite a bit more. And the way the symphony is set out in four movements in F major, it's quite original, and the way Roth interprets the piece is amazing as well. So I would really recommend this album, as I had recommended in the review, and I think it's one of the highlights of the year, actually, if I was to make a suggestion.
Okay, since that's useful to know. Yeah.
It's also Beethoven year, so something interesting which maybe could be talked about, the way the Fifth Symphony is interpreted.
Yeah, good.
Another album which was really good was this Minnesota Orchestra, Osmovanska Kulierwo, which is quite a good piece. One of my favorite pieces by Sibelius, actually. It was my introduction to his music a few years ago, like 30 years ago, something like that. And again, it's quite a long symphony. It's basically not that well known, although I've had three or four recordings in the past four years. I had reviewed the one with Hannu Lintu and the Estonian Orchestra and Polytech Choir, and the Finnish National Symphony for Ondine, I think for music for the website as well.
You have, yeah.
And there's the Hyperion recording, which is very good. I don't think we had done that one, but this BIS recording is actually one of the best I've heard. The sonics are really amazing, and Vanska's direction is very, very good, especially in the final movement, the final choral movement. it's a very original piece. Sibelius, you know, we know him from the Second Symphony, Finlandia, and all those more famous pieces. But the Kuljerovo Symphony, which is one of his earlier works, 1892, is actually something which could do with a resurrection. It's seeing a lot of recordings, as we said. And this latest one is really good. I think I put one of the top two or three recordings. I had started with the Bernmet Symphony with Pavel Berglund. That was the only recording of Kuljerovo in those days. But now we have lots to choose from. And this one, I think, goes to the top of the pile as well.
So you like this new one, say, better than the one you reviewed before, do you?
Yes, I think it's better. It's better. Yeah, the orchestra playing is better. Mm-hmm. The choral balance is better. Although Linto was good, but this one is a mite better, I would say.
Good.
Well, another CD which we've had reviewed is the Hans Roth Orchestral Works. I didn't do that one, but I've heard the recording. I've got a copy for myself, and I think it's really absolutely spellbinding. You know, Hans Roth died at just 24 years old, a real tragedy of a life. Many years ago, I had listened to the First Symphony, his only symphony, which is like very Mahlerian in character.
And yeah, which, I heard it. Yeah.
Yes, I think it's one of the most amazing symphonies, which isn't at all well known. But now maybe with this orchestral work series, Roth will get some credit for his amazing music.
Yeah, I hope so.
The Pastoral Prelude, which is the final work on the CD, which is something really out of this world. The fugal finale is fantastic, and the way it closes. It is inspired by Mahler and Bruckner, but he's got an original voice which is heard in the symphony, which will probably be the next CD in the Capriccio series, which is absolutely amazing. This Pastoral Prelude, and even the Hamlet Overture. So for a very young composer who was practically had a couple of years of creative activity, it's quite something to hear this music. So it's something we should look forward to next year, maybe.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? Anything happening in Malta, classical music-wise, at the moment?
Well,
you
know, at the moment, Malta's quite quiet with music. We haven't had any concerts, any performances, obviously, with all this COVID thing going on. There's been a couple of online streaming performances, but nothing to talk about, really. Although in December, this month, we should have some Beethoven performed by the National Orchestra, which will be streamed live with a select small audience in early December, which will be the first real performance we've had since March. So that's something to look forward to as well, because it's the Beethoven anniversary coming up, you know, in a few days.
Yeah.
And that's the main thing which I know of happening in Malta. But as we said, unfortunately, there's not much going on. Well, we've had also a great literary figure who passed away in the last few days. Oliver Frigeri was a very famous writer, poet, professor. He's internationally well known. And he's like being given accorded even a state funeral here in Malta, which is something very rare for non-political figures. So he's been featured in the news. He's quite a very important figure for Maltese culture, Maltese history, and even the Maltese language. So that's something which we've had in November, which was a sad event, but also something which celebrates one of our greatest literary talents as well. Well, and we will hope to have a good Christmas. Lots of music to listen to.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. There'll be lots online anyway. I don't know how many real performances, but you never know.
Yeah. There's so much to listen to, and something which is very interesting as well is even that Christmas CD, which the SWR recording, which was very nice, a cappella. That's very interesting as well to listen to. There were some very nice items on a very eclectic list. So I think that was pretty nice to do as well. One of the latest. That's good. And good. Another thing which we could talk about as well is the Rosebud Mahler set, which should be coming up, which I've just received recently.
That's and the one that got lost. That the one that got lost in the post.
Oh, yeah. Listen to some, actually, just before we hooked up for this short chat, and the first symphony is quite a very good performance. I would put it in the top 10, really, of Mahler. And I've had to listen to the Ninth Symphony as well, which is very good too. It's quite a boxy sound, but still, considering it's post-war German recordings from the 1950s from Cologne. But Rosebud was a very good Mahler interpreter, so it's interesting to hear his Mahler performances when Mahler wasn't all that well-known at the time, the early 50s. He wasn't, you know, like the cult figure he became in the 60s and 70s. So it's an interesting aspect. It's a very interesting set, which I look forward to continue listening, and the review should be presented very soon.
That's great, Gerald. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. I'm Julian Jacobson. Well, this year would have been absolutely full of Beethoven anyway, because of the 250th anniversary, and also because I'm chairman of the Beethoven Piano Society of Europe. So we decided very early on to put on all 35 sonatas, including the three early teenage Bonn sonatas for the Elector of Cologne, played by 35 different pianists. Then this whole business came along, so that, you know, we were absolutely determined that the show would go on, as they say. So most of the concerts had to be pre-recorded in another venue, but then we managed to stream almost everything online at the time it was announced with the same pianist, only one or two casualties. The last one, of course, coming up now, December the 16th, which is the great man's birthday. I was going to be sharing that with an American Uruguayan pianist, Enrique Graf. He can't possibly come over from America for that. So I'm having to swat up the Pathétique as well as Opus 111, which I always was going to finish with. Chairman's privilege. In addition to that, I've been giving various masterclasses, seminars, webinars on Beethoven. I've had enough of the old sod for one year, but there we go. Great composer. We'll give him a rest next year, I think. But haven't entirely been doing that. I also played the Liszt B minor sonata, the reopening of St. John Smith Square back in August. That was supposed to be live at literally the last moment, literally the day of the concert. The government decreed that there should be no live audience. So I just went off there and played it to an empty hall. I've also published a couple of pieces, a Valse Mélancolique for cello and piano. I mean, that's an old piece, but finally got published. And a piece for piano duet, which is called Palm Court Waltz. And it's in memoriam Richard Rodney Bennett. So it's a little bit late to publish it, but it's actually written after his death and using his great skills as a light music and film composer. In fact, it actually quotes from the Orient Express Waltz.
Whoa.
So that's good starters.
It's a lot.
You heard British pianist, composer and conductor Julian Jacobson playing the opening of the Andante con moto, second movement of Beethoven's Appassionata Sonata, at one of Julian's Beethoven Marathon concerts at St. Martin in the Fields, London, in 2013. You also heard Julian in conversation with Russian pianist Halli Dadinova. Now, Mike Wheeler, who's been monitoring Opera North's productions online in the UK.
Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht's The Seven Deadly Sins is, in the words of Weill's biographer David Drew, a unique and unrepeatable mixture of cantata and ballet. Dating from 1933, Brecht and Weill's final collaboration is a cautionary tale of ideals running up against pragmatic materialism. The central character, Anna, is on a seven-year journey around the seven American cities, earning money to enable her family to build a dream house by the Mississippi. She's portrayed by both a singer and a dancer. Anna One, the singer, refers to them as sisters, but they are really two halves of a single personality. As they move from city to city, they experience each of the classical seven deadly sins in turn: sloth, pride, anger, gluttony, lust, greed, and envy.
Hi, my name is Wallace Junta, and I am an Irish-Canadian mezzo-soprano. I sing the role of Anna, and this is a story of a young woman who's on a journey across America over 7 years, and in each city she goes to, she encounters one of the seven deadly sins. It's an incredible piece of music, really dance heavy, very beautiful visually, and we have an entirely socially distanced production. Yeah, we did it.
The family, mother, father, and two brothers, sung by an all-male quartet, offers comments at intervals. Director and choreographer Gary Clark's new production for Opera North, using Michael Feingold's English translation, was originally intended as part of a double bill with Handel's Acis and Galatea. That plan had to be shelved, and a single performance was streamed live from Leeds Playhouse. The orchestra, ranged across the back of the stage, and conductor James Holmes had all the idiomatic pungency of early 1930s Weill, using a version of the score for 15 players by H.K. Gruber and Christian Spiel. Clark's view of the family as refugees was underlined at the start, as the two Annas, mezzo-soprano Wallace Junta and dancer Shelley Eva Hayden, entered wearily carrying suitcases. As the piece proceeded, they moved around numbered areas marked out on the floor. The spaces between were a no-man's land occupied by the family, who, in true Brechtian style, held up boards to indicate which city we were in and which sin we were dealing with. The set was designed by George Johnson Lee and lit by Mike Locke to give the feel of an abandoned film studio, with the famous Hollywood sign ever present in the background. Junta's Anna One was every inch the imperious, hard-headed realist, determined to act for what she thought was the best, whatever the personal cost. Hayden, almost as much a gymnast as a dancer, conveyed Anna Two's increasing desperation in an extraordinary loose-limbed repertoire of movements. The family, Campbell Russell, father, Stuart Lang and Douglas Butterfield, the brothers, and Dean Robinson, mother, caught the family's sententious, moralizing tone without resorting to caricature. And so, as Anna started raking in the chips, the screw of hopelessness turned ever tighter. at the end, as Anna too lay crushed and humiliated, the look on Wallace Junta's face told us that it was beginning to dawn on Anna One just what an awful thing she'd done.
Very good. Great, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, very good, yeah.
Thank you.
I liked it.
Okay, over to you, Giuseppe.
I'm Giuseppe Pennisi. I'm an Italian. I live in Rome. In Italy, we are under lockdown. There's lockdown for the theaters, lockdown for the concert halls, and lockdown for restaurants and everything after 6 p.m. In Rome, we are in what we can call the low lockdown area. In Milan, is a high, much stricter lockdown. Anyhow, since all this COVID business started, I couldn't go to theaters as much I'd love. In the past, I would review quite frequently live operas and live concerts, and I would travel to La Scala, to Naples, to Palermo, to Parma, to everywhere. Now I stay at home, and I can see every so often performances on streaming or on national TV. On the way on Rai, which is the state-owned national TV, they have performances. Because the Italian theaters, the Italian theaters belong to what they are called the 12 symphonic and opera foundations. They receive the same subsidies from the government, so they can keep their basic orchestra, chorus, and all the rest, administrative stuff, and all the rest. And in exchange for that, they produce new operas, new concerts, and they can show them either on streaming or on web TV, or for the most important, or for the more important things, on national TV. Tonight, for instance, at 9 o'clock tonight after dinner, we will see Othello on a new production with Zubin Mehta conducting from Florence. And I will write a review tomorrow. I will receive photographs and I will write a review and all. Then on December 5, on 5 December, the Rome Opera House will start its season with a new Don Giovanni in the afternoon, at 4:15 in the afternoon, and the Pisa Theater will have a short opera at night. So I may be able to get 2 reviews. So there is also going on now the major festival of contemporary music, and I will try to see 1 or 2 performances, only 1 or 2 performances, and maybe to write a review. So I feel pretty busy also because I've got also some other work to do, even though I'm retired.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Giuseppe. You keep well and safe. Maria Nockin and her friend, the book editor and poet John Paliden, have been sampling a new phenomenon in these strange times, the drive-in opera. Maria, how many of these have you been to?
I've been to 2 of them. At San Diego's drive-in opera, which had 400 cars, and they bought an FM station, so they expect to do quite a bit more of it to make that investment come out for them. So they had, I think, 4 performances with 400 cars at each, and they charge something like $165 to $300 per car, figuring there can be 4 people in a car.
Yeah.
But most of the time it's 2. Some of them are 1.
Just last week, San Diego Opera was transforming the Pechanga Arena parking lot into Paris of the 1840s. Now, it can stage a pop-up drive-in version of La Boheme that addresses the challenging onstage protocols of performing live during COVID, says director Keturah Stickan.
One of the biggest ones being that each singer needs 120 square feet of their own wherever they are on stage, meaning that they cannot be any closer than 15 feet from the person that they are singing towards and no closer than 4 feet on either side.
Those protocols also affect the orchestra pit, says conductor Rafael Peari.
For the orchestra, a strings player is 6 feet, and the woodwind and brass is actually 12 feet. And for me as a conductor, also 12 feet between me and the next musician.
Peari, the music director at San Diego Symphony, is making his debut with San Diego Opera and loving it.
Opera itself, everything's so dramatic, you know, and you get involved in this world and you feel and you cry and you get overjoyed for everything. But especially since, you know, what is happening in the world, we have been deprived for this. So just the fact that we're being able to do it is going to bring up a lot of excitement.
And you listen on the FM radio, don't you? Which is quite a novel thing, really.
Well, that's what's different about it. The performance are live. Basically, they make stages atop a shipping container. They just put the shipping container where you can accommodate a stage. It already has a little ladder on it to climb up, which is not too easy if you got a fancy dress. They do it. And they work microphones. I'm not sure where the microphones are. You can't necessarily see them. And some people may have mics on them, you know, mics in the air or something or other. And the orchestra is someplace quite separate. And the players have microphones in their own little set off place. They have screens in front of them, particularly wind players. And some of them may play with special masks on. But that sound has to be mixed with the vocal sound by somebody.
Do you mean that they're in a different location completely, the orchestra?
Yeah, they're off to the side and sort of by themselves. The singers can't necessarily see them. They can watch the conductor on a monitor.
So if you had the car window open and you turned the radio down, would you better hear anything at all? Or is all the sound coming through the FM?
John says yes, he tried that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay.
It mixes here. Well.
Hi, John. Hi, John.
There's no lag.
Okay. Right. Interesting.
I expected a lag and there wasn't.
Yeah, it's not Zoom. It's something better than that when it comes on the FM. Because we all know Zoom's got that lag.
Yeah, well, Zoom's digital and FM is analog, so it's instant. You see, it's the speed of light. You know, it's just radio waves. So that's why there's no lag.
Now, both performances had two screens on either side of the stage, up higher than the stage. So even if you're far back in the parking lot, you can watch close-ups on those screens like you see in the HD.
The interesting thing about the screen is when you're watching the central stage, the singers are distanced from each other. Yeah. But due to the camera techniques that are used to produce the screen images, the performers look much closer to each other.
Okay.
So there's a lot of very interesting camera work going on to get the screen images that are either stage left or stage right.
Yeah. They've obviously put a lot of thought into this, haven't they? A huge amount of thought.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, the original one, you know, was it something called Alley Pally outside of London? You know that?
I know it. I've been there. Yeah.
So San Diego Opera did its best to copy that and then had its own, you know, additions to it. I heard from somebody in Holland the other day, and he wanted to know all about how to do it. I think you're going to hear somebody's got drive-in opera in Holland.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. It's one of the things we can do now, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only difference is in Europe, everybody doesn't have a car. In California, of course, everybody has a car.
That is a big difference. They could maybe rent boxes with FM radios in or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be
somebody who has a car.
Yeah, maybe. But then But then you've got the virus transmission problems, haven't you, as well? You people yeah. might not want to yeah. share cars or something. It's yeah. very, yeah. very complicated situation.
Well, for us, when we were in either my house or John's house, or in one of our cars, we're still quarantined because these are places we are on a daily basis and nobody's there but us.
Yeah.
So we figured the only chance we took is we had to stay in a motel to go to California.
Yeah.
So we left very early in the morning and got to the motel before people even left that were there the night before. Okay. So we know the room we got was not rented the night before.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
We asked for a room that wasn't rented. Yeah. And they accommodated us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, very, very good.
So that's pretty much the story on it. If anybody wants to do it, please put them in touch with me.
Okay.
I'll put them in touch with either San Diego Opera. Well, I didn't tell you what Pacific Opera Project did. They're an opera company with a lot less money. They did performances and are doing some more next week that will be there are 90 cars at each performance. Right. They found a preacher who has an FM station and said, can we use your parking lot when you're not broadcasting church services?
Mm-hmm. And their FM station.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
There's actually going to, if this thing carries on too long, there's going to be a market for parking lots, you know, which people can rent to do performances.
There already is.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who runs Pittsburgh Festival Opera said she's been looking all over, and somebody else I know in San Diego and San Francisco, both of them have been looking for places to do this and mm-hmm. find that the price has gone sky high because everybody yeah. knows. There's some market for it.
Amazing.
In San Diego, we were in a parking lot, a very large parking lot, at a soccer complex. Mm. And there were other events going on in the parking lot. Various parts were closed off from other parts of the parking lot.
Yeah, I suppose actually, because on FM radio, you've got lots of channels, you know, different you can tune into different things. You could have 10 things going on in one parking lot with the cars pointing in different directions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could have a multi-opera.
Outdoor opera would, because it's live singers on a stage with a live orchestra in a tent. In both cases, the pop in Los Angeles and the San Diego opera, the tents were curiously housed stage left mm-hmm. for the performers.
Yeah.
The performers were all distanced. There were plastic partitions between some of the wind instruments. Mm-hmm. And as Maria said, there was masking for some of the instrumentalists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of them would ask for that, you know, they need it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you could clearly, on a monitor from where we were parked, see the conductor at all times, okay. on a monitor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where was the conductor? Was the conductor in front of the singers or in front of the orchestra?
In front of the orchestra, and okay. the orchestra was stage left.
Yeah.
But I could, anyway, see a monitor which showed the conductor all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the singers would have to have a monitor as well in front of them.
They must have had one somewhere.
Facing the stage, or several. Yeah.
One on either side.
Yeah.
It must be quite peculiar performing in something like that, mustn't it? Because it must be quite different to normal performance.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And I'm sure rehearsal is required to iron out some of those things.
I bet, yeah.
Because you got a big rule book from the state of California.
25-page rule book from the state.
Did you set the rules you got to music?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Can we get a copy of that?
I'll send you it. It's not actually music, it's Anglican chant, you know, religious chant.
Sure.
Well, that's all right.
I'll send it you, yeah.
I used to be a cantor in the Catholic Church, so it's pretty familiar stuff. Yeah.
It was a bit of fun. Unfortunately, the day after we did it and performed it on, did it with a choir, they changed the rules. And so it was out of date. So I need to do a new one.
Joshua of Pacific Opera Project wrote a new libretto for COVID on Tuesday. And I want to see if I can get a copy of it. It's well put together. It's rhymed. It's really funny.
And singable.
Yeah.
Wow.
Singable and rhymed, which means Josh had nothing to do for a few months, so he wrote something.
Yeah. That's good.
I know he said he was depressed, but if you can do stuff like that when you feel depressed, that's maybe what it really takes.
Thank you very much, Maria and John, and thank you everyone who's helped to make this newsletter. One thing we've discovered while making this podcast is that it's much more difficult than when writing a PDF newsletter to mention everything which has been published during the last month. There are many more CD reviews, all illustrated with sound samples, a handful of concert reviews, various bits of news and obituaries, and a profile interview with British pianist Leon McCauley, courtesy of Annette Fodor. So please visit our site at classicalmusicdaily.com and read at least some of what's been published over the last month or so. At our homepage, if you select newsletters from the latest menu and then follow the link to this podcast newsletter, which is number 143, then you'll find links to, hopefully, everything mentioned here, plus details of how to contact us. The advertising and copy dates for our January 2021 newsletter are both Monday the 21st of December 2020. I'm Keith Bramich. We hope you have a safe and productive December, and we leave you with Patrick Maxwell reviewing the complete piano music of Lennox Barclay as played by Douglas Stevens on the Hoxha label.
Lennox Barclay's music, which has never held the widespread acclaim that greeted the works of Britten and Tippett in the middle of the last century, nevertheless evokes much of the same themes which such more renowned names encapsulated. Troubled by the events of the century, there is a unique and modern dissonance lying under any more romantic themes, but the pastoral uncertainties of an England fading into the distance are an essential presence. And still, almost more importantly, underneath much of the music there is yet an inherent playfulness and fullness of voice, which speaks mainly of his passionate inventiveness and genuistic craftsmanship. Douglas Stevens has, in this recording, exposed some of the more unduly neglected works of the unfairly deserted beast of English 20th century piano music. Although it showcases pieces from the smallest incidental sketch to the most serious sonata, much of the same qualities are in evidence throughout this disc, as is the sparkling tendency to swerve into dissonance and unfamiliar musical territory. The six preludes, op. 23, are some of the most jaunty and lively pieces on this disc, composed in 1945, around the time that Barclay left the BBC after the war. The first movement possesses much of this life before the more lyrical andante takes the listener along a characteristically wide tour of the tonal spectrum. The next movement, Allegro Moderato, is among the most technically brilliant included and uses this playfulness to full effect. Melodies coincide with counter-melodies and each form a whole which moves forward at each new bar before fading away. One could say that this music seems transient, a brief catharsis without much real bass. Yet, with each new movement, Barclay layers gain yet another emotional veil, and there is created in each a new theme or idea which only adds vigour to the others. The fifth prelude, Allegro, shows Barclay again at his technical height, mixing a melodic verve with the tonal pyrotechnics which cascade through the score and ear. The next movement again makes full use of his characteristic contrasts with the sound world which speaks of the composer's time in France, as is true of much of this early music. The piano sonata op. 20 of the same year shows his ability to work on longer works, albeit with many of the same contrasts of vibrant virtuosity and more mysterious plaintive reflection. His harmonic structures, such as they are, may owe much to the French music of the first half of that century, but they are also markedly distinct. Emotions are simpler, the harmonic torrents unleashed more brashly, more irresolutely. The first movement, Moderato, builds up a tension which develops through the independent voice of the right-hand melody, but yet it keeps a definite English feel, although one less secure or assured than that of Vaughan Williams or the works of Britten which came before him. The Adagio, third movement of this piece, is by far the most contemplative and simple, with a satie-like style of a repetitive bass, preparing the stage for the more complex and soloistic treble line. Barclay possesses in this music a magisterial power of melodic control as he puts together this effervescent piece, basking as it is in the higher stratosphere of the register. Stevens, handling some of the most challenging music in the repertoire, plays throughout with a vigorous attention to the intricate details of the pieces, although more lightness of touch in the face of the more relentless music would be desired. Especially once Barclay's more complex harmonies begin to spread even wider. The three piano pieces of 1935, Op. 2, show the same mix of exuberance and tenderness from an earlier part of Barclay's career, when he went to Paris under the tutelage of Nadia Boulanger and came across and was heavily influenced by figures such as Poulenc and Stravinsky. Some of this music becomes darker as the years progress. The third of the four concert studies of 1972, Op. 24, No. 1, seems forlorn and almost destitute in its eventual resolution. Stevens tells us, in his excellent programme notes, that the idea that Barclay lost much of his lyricism after the 1950s should be resisted. Although there is certainly less of the cantabile style to be found than in, say, the Paysage of 1944, a wonderfully developed yet almost simple piece which transports us back to the sound world of sharp contrasts between contemplation and strict verbosity. The improvisation on a theme of Manuel de Falla of 1960, Op. 55, is the nearest example of any kind of return to form on show here, and its deeply contemplative tone may speak of the composer's increasingly morose turn of mind. Even if Barclay's legacy will continue to rest largely on his more famous compositions for orchestra and voices, these piano works deserve a recognition that can hope to improve upon that which has greeted the music of most of the composer's contemporaries in their efforts for the keyboard thus far. For Douglas Stevens has given all his works here a brilliant series of renditions, one that shows the kind of musical dedication which is to be celebrated in the rare cases where it has achieved to greatest effect. It requires a concentration of soulful willpower and an unassuming integration into what can only be described as the mind of the composer themselves. Many more should look on such accomplishments as this and be glad.